Now, once again, here's Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock, or I'm sorry, 10 o'clock. 4 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. I'm looking at two different clocks at the same time. And we're going to be here for the next 2 hours talking about car repair problems, car repair questions. What should I do about this? What do you think about that? This is what my brother told me to do. This is what my garage said to do. So I have lots of years of experience, 40 years of experience in the car repair industry. And I'm an ASE master technician, and I own my own shop. And this isn't about my shop. This is about you and your car issues. So I can give you the very best advice I can give you, and I can always defend the advice as well. That's where it really kind of rubs, where the rubber meets the road is whose benefit are we talking about when we start talking about many of the suggested processes and fluid flushes that you're being offered as you go in and out of your own car repair shop. And that's what it's kind of all about. So 602-508-0960 is the phone number, 602-508-0960. And we've got a caller already, so we're going to take Mark because he was first to jump on the gun. And, Mark, how can I help you today?
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for taking my phone call.
You bet.
I'm up in Prescott with a church retreat of a bunch of young adults, and one of them has had a problem with his car, and we don't know if we can risk taking it back to the valley. So I'm going to let Jonathan tell you what the make, model, year, miles of his car is, and what the symptoms of his problem are.
Sure.
Hi, Mark. This is Jonathan.
Hi, Jonathan.
All right. So I've got a... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
All right. So I've got a 2012 Nissan Altima, and we were coming up the mountain into Prescott, about three-quarters of the way up. It's a pretty steep incline the whole way. One of the more steep inclines, we started losing acceleration. It seemed like it wasn't kicking into lower gear to go up the hill. So had to pull off for a second, give it a rest, turn it off, turn it back on. It still seemed a little sluggish going up that hill. Once we kind of got over the steep inclines, it did okay, but it just felt a little different. The check engine light came on, and I got a torque converter clutch circuit intermittent code when I downloaded that off of the car. So just trying to see if it's something we need to take in now or if it might be able to get down to the valley first, or just kind of your general thoughts on it.
How many people were in the car?
Four, which is not normal. I usually only have myself or me and my wife, but we were carpooling with a couple other people, so we had full car with luggage and all that.
Okay. The torque converter clutch code could mean that the computer's talking out loud. I expected it to unlock and downshift as you started up those hills, but it didn't. Who was driving? Were you driving, Jonathan?
Yeah, I was driving.
Okay. And when you were going up those hills, did you have your foot on the floor?
Yeah, I was all the way to the floor.
That's okay. Now, you could have shifted it by manually shifting it. You could have taken a control of the shift lever itself and pulled it down one gear, and you could have done that. During this period of time, did you ever smell anything unusual?
Not that I noticed.
Uh-uh. Okay. I would say, heck, if I were in Prescott and you wanted to go back to Phoenix, I'd go with you, and I'd probably leave my tow card, you know, in my truck. So I don't think that what it sounds like to me is that you ended up pretty much floorboard throttle all the way up, and I wish you would have just taken control of the shift points yourself. So you have a column shift, or is it on the center console?
On the center console.
Yeah. See, you can take that shifter and pull it all the way down to the bottom, and then that's like first gear, and then you click up second gear, and click up third gear, and so forth and so on. And oftentimes there's
I'm not sure if my car had that, because all I saw, because I kind of checked that, because I thought it might be a low gear kind of problem, and it only had the drive. I didn't see another gear for me to go down into.
Okay.
Do some of those cars have that and some don't?
Well,
unless there's some other way that it can be downshifted.
Well, does CVT transmission appear anywhere on the exterior of the car, CVT, constant velocity transmission?
I don't think so.
Okay.
That's what I've noticed.
All righty. But on the shift console, it only has drive. It doesn't have any other designation or stopping points or what we call indents.
Yeah, not that I see. It just goes, you know, straight up and down, and I see PR and D.
Okay. Are you in the car right now?
No, it's not.
It's okay. It's okay. Well, I don't know that I'm real worried about this. I think that you had four people in a car, and I think that you probably were close to or on the floor most of the time when you were climbing into the Prescott area, and that's kind of normal. And the check engine light is yellow for a reason, and that means yellow is caution. It doesn't mean stop. So anything red, like oil or an overheat red, that means stop. But, no, I think it's a good chance that on your way home you won't have any problem because you're obviously going downhill instead of uphill.
Right.
And I would just, the shifter itself has an indent. It's a park, and then you push a button, and it pulls it down into reverse, and then you can go to neutral, and then you can push a button or a lever or something to go into drive. And then usually below drive, there's some other gears. And it's really a matter of you manipulating the shifter itself. But if you could get it to where you can manually shift from one through third or one through fourth, and that way you could check to see if each one of those gears is there. But how many miles are on the Altima? That's the only thing we don't know yet.
Yeah, 137,000.
Okay. Normally we see transmissions in the 150 to 200 range is when they start giving up the ghost. And usually there's going to be a symptom that starts but doesn't ever disappear. And that's the kind of the beginning of the end. But I don't know. Like I said, you haven't given me anything that really upsets me and suggests that you or your passengers' lives are going to be in danger on the way back to Phoenix. So if I were with you, I'd be going with you.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. That sounds good. Yeah, appreciate it.
All right, good luck to you. Good luck to you. All righty, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open. We have five lines, and now we have four lines open. But, Gil, who's next?
Say hello to Don.
Don, good morning.
Good morning, Mark Salem. Listen, I have a tooth. How are you?
I'm good.
Okay, I have an 01 GMC Sonoma 4-banger, 2.2, and I'm getting a weird rattle. It seems to be coming from behind the instrument panel, and it peaks out at about 3,000 RPM, and it initially started with a stuck throttle body, and it oversped the engine to up to around 6,000 RPM intermittently, a couple of things. So I took it apart and cleaned it out with chem tool and stuff, put it back together, and it still had the problem. And the tach seems to be sticking at about 3,000, then it'll jump back down as soon as I let off on the gas. But anyway, last night it stuck one time yesterday on the road. I came home and I got real close and inspected it, and I found about a 6-inch preformed rubber hose leading off the back of the airbox down to the valve cover that was flopping in the wind. Now, would that cause throttle body malfunctions if I connect that back up? Or what would you suggest? Is that a PCV valve in the valve cover?
Well, I don't know. We're going to – I mean, your car, your engines is going to have the ability to draw fumes off of the engine and send them down through the throttle body and burn them again. So we're going to have a circle. Positive crankcase ventilator is one of them, PVC. PCV valve, positive crankcase ventilator. But, yes, the answer is absolutely you should hook the hose back up. If you can see that it came from here, then, yes, hook it up. If it's not a good tight fit, then maybe get a little plastic tie and put it around there and tighten it up. Or if you've got hose, cut off a half an inch on the end and put the hose back on the nipple that it belongs on. But none of that concerns me. It's not uncommon for us to and what's really throttle bodies are notoriously just perfect. I don't know the last time we took a throttle body apart for any reason whatsoever, other than to replace the throttle position sensor or idle air control motor. But the throttle body is just not a real big deal. Has the throttle ever stuck? Has it ever not been responsive to you, the throttle?
It stuck three times intermittently between gears. And then as soon as I put it in gear, let the clutch out, the throttle, the RPMs come down, and it runs normally again. But it just sticks wide open. when it's not under load. It's only happened three times.
Okay.
But,
what I hear you saying is that there are times when your foot's not on the gas at all,
yeah.
but the RPMs are up as if your foot was on the gas.
Yes.
Okay.
It's wide open. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's an air leak. Almost always that's an air leak. And if you have a vacuum line that interfaces between the engine and the intake manifold and the throttle body, then that uninhibited rise in idle is related to the air leak that you just found. So,
PCV valve maybe.
It could be the PCV valve, the PCV valve line. It could be just a simple vacuum line that goes from one place to the other. To get an engine, a fuel injection engine to increase in speed, we give it air. So it's not uncommon for us to have an air leak in the vacuum system of a gasoline powered car and have the idle be uncontrolled.
Yeah.
So I think we're both on the same track that hose needs to be reconnected. And if you want to, you can disconnect the negative cable and just set it aside for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, and that will reboot all the parameters on the computer. And it's kind of like a control alt delete on your computer on your desk.
Oh, okay.
And then it forces
negative on the battery and just let it sit there for a while.
Yeah, the computer is going to go out and reestablish all the parameters.
Yeah.
So
the throttle body is controlled by the computer.
Oh, well, your throttle blades are controlled by your foot. And then of course as we open the flap to give the engine air, then the throttle, the computer's job is to add fuel to that air to get you to move down the road.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So,
I'll do that. I'll connect the hose and disconnect my battery for 10 minutes or so, or half hour.
No, you don't even need that far. I mean, 5 minutes is fine. Just disconnect the battery and just take the negative cable off, set it aside for, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. That's all you need. And then just put it back on, okay?
If this solves the problem, I'll call you back and tell you thank you for your help.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
That's good enough. Thank you.
All righty.
Yeah, it's in the old days with carburetors, when we had a vacuum leak, it would bring the idle up a little bit, because we're adding extra air to the motor. But in a throttle body, in a fuel injected environment, the effect of a vacuum leak is slightly larger, so slightly bigger, and the effect of the RPM bounce is bigger. But it's no real big deal, because neither way, it's not like you're going to put it in drive and the car's going to take off and go 100 miles an hour. That's not going to happen. It hasn't happened. I've not seen it happen, although I've seen stuck throttles on fuel-injected cars where people ultimately died because they couldn't get control of the car. It's always been a very easy-to-explain mechanical reason why that happened. I can remember one time where someone had taken the air filter off of a pickup truck, and they aspirated a bird in the ductwork by the grill where fresh air comes into the engine and through the air filter. But the air filter was gone, so the bird stuck into the throttle blades and caused the RPMs to end up to be about 60 miles an hour. And obviously, if that happens to you ever, all you do is shove it into neutral and just coast to the side of the road. And when you come to the stop, then shut it off. That's all you do. Just put your car into neutral. We don't care. The motor's going to be screaming. We don't care. We don't care. We don't care. Nobody cares. Just off to the side of the road. Turn the key off, and you're done. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. I'm real happy to share with you my list of the best car repair shops in the Valley. I've been in the Valley since I was in high school, and that was in the 1970s. And I know a lot of shop owners, and I've been around the block a few times, and I can pretty much tell you who's a good shop and who isn't and probably why. But I only talk about the good guys on the show. Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing in Mesa, been around since 1970. Brian and Thelma both come from families that used to sell gasoline in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. So Brian and Thelma have been around the gas station business, the service station business, the car repair business all their lives. So the only place in Mesa that has passed the muster, the only place in Mesa that has all the credentials necessary to put me in a complete comfort zone and say to you, if you're in Mesa, the only shop I can recommend is Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing, and they're on Main Street just east of Stapley. Richard, good morning. How can I help you?
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you. Good.
I have a unique situation. 2016 Mitsubishi Outlander SUV, all-wheel drive, 173,000 miles. About a month and a half ago, I got in my car and started and wanted, you know, it started to take off. Well, I took it out of park and put it in the drive. Well, I put it into low gear, and I'm like, okay, well, I need to push it up. It wouldn't go into drive. Bottom line, the transmission cable had snapped, and there are some other linkage parts that were somehow damaged, broken, what have you. The interesting thing is when I had gone back to the dealership to get it repaired, they told me that Mitsubishi no longer makes the part, and I can go to a junkyard and get the parts. They'll pull it, put it in, but no guarantee. The bottom line is I remedied it by buying a new vehicle, but I have to get rid of the vehicle off their property. And I was just wondering, a car that relatively not that old, and they don't make parts any longer for it in the, you know, for the United States market, but they do make it for the Asian and European market.
Well, wow. This is not the first time I've heard this story in okay. any way, shape, or form. There is a lot of us out there that would hear what you just said and say that somebody is just playing games, somebody wants to sell you a new unit, somebody wants to take your car and put it back onto the lot. There's lots of things that could be going on behind the scenes. So,
sure.
And to be honest with you, we can still find parts for cars from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, and so I'm real struggling. Plus, we've got a lot of Mitsubishis in junkyards, and there's lots of parts that are there. And changing your question around and saying, when was the last time, Mark, you couldn't fix a car because they didn't make the part anymore? It's never happened. It just never happened.
Gotcha.
So I think what you need to do. How many miles did you have on this?
173.
Okay. And of course, there are some really good transmission shops in the Valley that could do this. But what typically happens is that we no longer have the skill level necessary to rebuild them. So Mitsubishi will then make a transmission, and it'll go in a crate, and it'll be shipped to the dealer. And then if somebody needs a transmission, they just get the crated transmission. You can circumvent this whole thing by calling a couple of other service departments of other Mitsubishi dealers and just simply say to them, I have this 16 Mitsubishi and it's an Outlander and it's an all-wheel drive SUV and I'm told it needs a transmission. Here's my name and phone number. Would you call me back and give me an estimate on the replacement of my transmission? Thank you very much. Now, if they say, who's the one that told you that they didn't have the parts in it, don't tell them the answer to that. Just say to them, that's what I was told, face-to-face or on the phone. That's what I was told. Because a lot of times what they'll do is blame one another. And in the independent
gotcha.
Market and the chain store market, we do the same thing. I mean, it happens throughout our industry. But I'm willing to bet that with a little bit of work, you'll find that there's going to be a transmission in a crate somewhere in the United States that can be shipped here, and somebody can take your old one out and put the new one in, and you're done. So I'm quite sure.
Gotcha.
I'm 99% sure that can happen. I think somebody just I don't know why they say stuff like that. I don't know why.
Okay, so just check around other dealerships and see who has it, who would have that part, etc.
Yeah, and if you wanted to have fun with it, this is how it would sound. And I'm Richard. Hi, my name is Richard, and I had some transmission problems with my Outlander and da 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 da. And I took it to this transmission store here in town, and I guess they're well respected and world renowned, and they do lots of transmission work. And they told me that I didn't have a choice, that I had to have this transmission. And if, then one of two responses you'll get from the person on the phone that you're talking to, they're either going to jump all over that, or they're going to say, that's craziness. You need to refocused to some other shop. So we have a bad habit in the automobile industry of bad-mouthing one another, depending on whose ox is being gored. But if you have, and then the fun part about it is, this one lady did this, and I thought it was genius. She called back to the same store, and she told the story as if it was another store, and they jumped all over the other store, which really was their store. She had them stepping and fetching and dancing and backing up, and managers are involved and all kinds of stuff. It was pretty comical, but I don't think I'd be willing to give up just yet. And if you want to send me an email, mark@marksalem.com, I'm happy to do one thing for nothing, and give me your VIN number, and I'll check to see if there is a transmission available anywhere in the state of Arizona that would plug right in and play on your car. Okay.
All right, and can I have your email address again, please?
Yep, it's Mark with a K at MarkSalem.com. Mark@MarkSalem.com, and I'll look and then leave me your phone number too. And know that I'm going to call you on a blocked line for obvious reasons. So if I call on a blocked line, sure. I usually spill my guts and leave a message for you, and then I usually say, hey, I'll call you back in about 10 minutes, and then under those conditions, you'll answer the blocked phone number and know it's me. So, but I'll help you out with
Mark,
this.
Thank you so much.
All right, you're welcome, Richard.
I appreciate it.
You betcha. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Kurt's Auto Repairs, a shop that I have always been proud to be affiliated with. Kurt is just a rock-solid guy, and ironically enough, his last name is Rock, Kurt Rock. But he is really good. He's very honest. He's very dependable. He's very conscientious about what you're supposed to do in the auto repair industry. Plus, he has a level of staff experience there that is in the top 5% of all the shops in the valley, including my own. There are times that he's fixed cars that I've asked him to look at that I couldn't fix. So Kurt's Automotive is a good guy. He's at I-17 in Bell, the northeast corner. He's been around since 1987. He does gas and diesel. He does all kinds of repair work. But each and every time that he's ever been my hero or my customer's hero or my radio caller's hero is when he just had to say, well, this is what the truth is, and this is what it's going to cost you. I can just tell you that I sent a lady that had been told she needed an engine, and Kurt fixed it with an oil pressure switch, and I think the bill was like $60. That's a big deal. That's a really, really big deal. And it's a really big deal that somebody out there is lying about what the car needs so they can butter their bread with a $5,000 engine. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. We're going to be here till noon talking about car repair questions and problems. The lines are wide open. The phone number is 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. And you're welcome to call anytime you want. Excuse me. And then all you're going to do is give us your first name and tell us what kind of car you have and tell us what kind of problems that you're having with your car. It's that easy. Automatic transmission exchange has been around the Phoenix Valley area since 1968. Phil's going to be one of the first persons I call on Monday morning to find out about this Mitsubishi. Supposedly they don't make the transmission anymore for a car that's 4 or 5 years old. We hear that, and I don't remember it's ever been true, but there's a variety of reasons why it would be said, and that is to talk the person into a new car when really a new transmission is the better option. Nevertheless, automatic transmission exchanges on 40th Street in Washington. If you go up and down 40th Street or Jefferson, you're going to know where automatic transmission exchange is at because he's been there for a very, very long time. So it's one of the transmission shops that I suggest that you can go to for services, for leaks, for drivability concerns, stuff like that. It's the only one I've got in Phoenix that I can really point to and say, hey, they're good. That's automatic transmission exchange, 40th Street in Washington. 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open. 602-508-0960. Last week we got off on a tangent, and it was one that Mark goes off on a lot, and that is the idea that we're going to take your car and do stuff to it to make it perfect and all this other kind of stuff. One of the things that kind of drives me crazy is the idea that we're going to flush your fuel injection system, flush your injectors, we're going to clean up the inside of your engine, we're going to flush the oil system, we're going to flush the air system, we're going to do all this kind of stuff. And why is that something that comes up on my radar screen every day? It's because it's very lucrative for us to sell that. It's something that has very little risk and a huge reward. There's nothing that can happen. We're going to plug in a bunch of hoses to your car. We're going to start your car, walk away. It's going to go through this big process and flush everything out and give you back a brand new engine. Nothing could be further from the truth, but nevertheless, that's the perception. Well, the issue is when you take your car in for a repair or to a repair shop and they want to sell you something, there has to be some kind of mechanism that you have to recognize and use. For instance, okay, you're saying that you want to spend $299 flushing my fuel system. Tell me what symptoms I have today that you're going to eliminate. Think about that question. How's that person on the other side of your window going to know the answer to that? They don't have an answer for that because they don't drive your car and they don't know anything about your car. The fact of the matter is that somebody says you need to have your injectors flush. What they're talking about is flushing your wallet. They're talking about taking money that they don't really deserve to take. They're not telling you, you have a hesitation first thing in the morning, and it probably doesn't go away for the first 5 miles. And when you come to a traffic light, it probably idles rough. And then if it idles rough, and then when you go to stab the throttle to take off when the light turns green, it falls on its face. And you say, none of that applies to me. None of it. I don't have any of the symptoms that you just described. I don't have those. So in our industry, what we've got now is the days of the 3,000-mile oil change are gone. We're now into the 5,000, 7,000, 8,000-mile, 15,000-mile range on oil changes. So we used to take a peek at your car every 3,000 miles. You'd bring it in every 3,000 miles for an oil change, and we were supposed to check the fluids, the belts, the hoses, the tires. We're supposed to look it over, and we're supposed to advise you of things that you're going to be, something that you're going to need to deal with in the future. You've got a small little oil leak here, or you've got a radiator hose that's starting to swell up over here, or you've got a little bit of a rubber bushing here that's starting to come apart. Those are the kinds of things. Well, today, with many of your cars, and as you well know it, some of the cars are in between 7,500 and 15,000-mile oil change intervals. That means we only see you once a year. If we only see you once a year, our industry has a bad habit of making up stuff so that we can appropriately give you a service haircut. We can sell you things that you don't really need and create the perception that this is what's in your best interest and your car's going to love you and your car's never going to break down. And as long as I do this, last week we got off on a tangent, and I must admit, Mark got off on a tangent, and we started talking about that we were going to change the air in your tires. And because fresh air has got to be better than the air that's 10 years old inside your tires. And I'm being facetious here. I'm making a joke. We also talked about the driver's seat. We were going to create and invent a piece of equipment that you placed on the seat of the driver's seat, and it would desanitize and it would clean up the driver's seat. Because, as you can expect, the number one place, the dirtiest place in the car, is the driver's seat, because that's the one that gets used the most. Obviously, the car doesn't go anywhere unless there's a butt in the driver's seat. So we got off on this tangent about, you know, sanitizing the driver's seat and changing the air in your tires and all this other kind of stuff. And this is just because our industry, they make cars really good today. And we don't do a lot of maintenance and a lot of repairs on them for the first 100,000 miles. And as a result of that, now we're making up stuff that you need to have done to your car when really it doesn't appear in your owner's manual. And that's the default. Why don't you show me in my owner's manual where it says that you are going to desanitize my driver's seat and that's going to be a good thing for me? Show me in my owner's manual. But I'm making a joke about desanitizing the driver's seat. I'm making a joke about changing the air in your tires. But that's how ridiculous our industry gets when we start talking about those kinds of things. 602-508-0960. We'll be back in a minute. Well, welcome back, everybody. 43 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. Every Saturday, we're here from 10 o'clock till noon talking about car and car repair questions and problems. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. We have two callers on the line, but real quick, let me tell you about a shop. These are shops that I have personally picked to be really good shops because they were already good shops, and that's Larry Harker's Auto. 38th Avenue and Indian School's been around since Jesus was a baby. They know what they're doing. They're honest and they're dependable. When you walk in the front, you're going to meet, you're going to meet Ellen. I'm looking at paperwork and I should be focusing on telling you about them. But Ellen's the front counter. Bob, her husband, works the shop, and the two of them are a pair that know all about car repair. So if you have a car with a problem and it barks on Thursday at noon and nobody else can find it, Harker's Auto, 38th Avenue and Indian School, would be the place I would send you. Larry Harker's Auto, 38th Avenue and Indian School, because this is the kind of stuff that they excel in, as well as oil changes, tire rotations, fresh spark plugs, that kind of stuff. But when it comes to tracking something down, Harker's is one of the top shops in the valley that can actually track down problems and fix them. All right, let's go to the phones, and thank you very much, Scott, for holding. How can I help you?
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Mark, I've got a silly question. I've got some old GL5 gear oil, 7590 and 6590, or 7590 and 8590 gear oil for your third member, your rear end. Can I be safe to mix the two when I want to use it?
One of them is a 6590 and the other is a 7590?
No, it's a 7590 and a 8590.
Okay.
And I like to know if I can mix the two. I have a few bottles that are half full, and I like to know if I can mix the two.
And are you going to put this in a manual transmission, in a transfer case? Are you going to put it in a differential?
And what? In the rear end.
Okay, and the answer is yes, you can mix them.
I can mix them.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And it doesn't matter if it's one bottle is Napa and the other two are Valvoline. I can still do that?
No, you can still do that. First of all, there's only about four or five companies that make oil, and they just put them in different bottles for everybody else. So
okay.
when you get down to it and you look let me just tell you right now, the four major companies that are really involved in the production of oil from taking Mother Nature oil out of the ground and putting it in your car is Mobil, Shell, Phillips 66, and Chevron. Those are the four guys. Most everything comes from one of their manufacturing plants.
Okay.
So,
okay.
And the answer is it's not going to make any difference at all.
And it doesn't matter who makes it?
No, it doesn't.
Oh, all right. That sounds great. Because I just don't want to throw it. I mean, you know what I mean. If it's just sitting there, if I can mix it, I would like to mix it.
Well, it's not going to go bad, and it's a gear oil, and so it's not like an engine oil. It doesn't have a detergent in it. It's a gear oil, and all its job is to get in between the two teeth that are pushing on one another and
right.
not squeeze out. So
yeah.
All we're doing is we're coating the gears, that ring and pinion in your differentials with this oil because it's an oil bath situation where as the ring is spinning, the ring gear is spinning, it's splashing oil all over inside that housing, and that's it. So no, you're not gonna. If you're really gonna fret about it, then go take it down to the local auto parts store and tell them it's used oil and buy a brand new bottle of
yeah.
whatever. But if I were with you, or if that was in my inventory, I'd use it. That's what I'd do. Okay?
I thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You betcha. So Andy, you're next.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you.
Good. Hey, just a quick question for you. Just a clarification. If I remember right, it's been a while since I've looked at an owner's manual, but don't the manufacturers recommend flushes at certain intervals? In their car, their vehicles? And if so, are you saying that those aren't necessary, or you want to clarify that?
Yeah. No, there is lots of fluids that have specific and defined time stops, or when you change them and flush them and remove them. So transmission services, we're going to take the filter and the fluid, power steering systems, gear oil, differentials, transfer cases, they all have that. What I'm objecting to is my industry makes up a lot of stories and a lot of different stopping points that don't exist. And they create the perception that you need to have your fuel injectors flushed. Really and truly, there is nothing in any owner's manual I've seen in the last 10 years that says you need to flush your fuel injectors. And you know why? It's because it's kind of like a spark plug. If it starts missing, fix the damn thing. Okay? That's all there is to it. Just fix it.
Exactly.
So there is, there's nothing.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Okay. All righty. Yeah, there's a whole lot of flushing going on, and the only thing that's really good about the flushing is that the shop's making a lot of money flushing a lot of the fluids in your car, and really there's no benefit to you whatsoever, and we're not going to fix anything, and we're not going to make your car love you more, and we're not going to ensure that your car won't break down. All of that is just pure bull you know what. There's just no way your car has a mind and it's going to love you and never break down if you keep flushing all the fluids that your system holds. So that's just not going to happen. All righty, Andy? We got Andy?
Actually, we're done with Andy. Say hello to Tom.
Tom. Oh, I'm sorry, Tom. I'm going to Tom, and I just got done talking to Andy, and I know that, but I was looking at the wrong piece of paper. Okay, Tom, what can I do for you, buddy?
Yes. I'm looking for if you get any recommendations on salvage yards for getting used parts for the body parts themselves, you know, like front bumpers or anything like that.
Well, you just get on the internet and you there's a variety of groups that a bunch of salvage yards are under the same umbrella, and you just go onto their website, and if you're looking for a hood for a specific vehicle, then you look for the hood, and then they'll usually send you a picture of it, and it may or may not need some work on it, so it's not crumpled up, but it did take a softball in the center of the hood on a softball game 7 years ago. So you're going to have one dent on the top of the hood that you're going to have to fix before it turns into a pristine hood.
So, right,
but there's
right.
no place that you can go to get that. What's that?
Yeah. I didn't know if you'd have any recommendations on anybody being any better or anything like that.
Well, we are in that environment a lot. We do look, and we have a parts department, and I know Jeff and Sean, they'll find out exactly what they want, and typically it'll have a number associated with it that will be a universally accepted number, that this particular number means that this is fits on a 63 Corvair.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff. And so once you identify the part number, then you can go out there and start hopscotching around on the internet. But there's a lot of people that have their inventory on the internet, and you can do comparisons. Oh, wait a minute. This color is almost exactly the color I need. I should probably get this one as opposed to this guy's over here. So it's not that hard. It's just shopping on the internet. And once you get the OEM part number, you'll be better off.
Okay. All right.
Okay?
All right. Yep, thanks.
All right, you betcha. After the used part junkyard kind of market, is a big market. There's lots of good parts out there, parts that you can save a lot of money on when you're going to start fixing your car. We oftentimes buy used parts because A, they're available, B, the new part is expensive, and I can buy a used part and I can check it, and then I can install it, and I can put new wheel bearings on the spindle assembly. That's one that we just did here recently, and put it all back in, and everything is fine. And so we're confident that this is the right part. And in reality, you'll figure out real quick if it's not the right part, because it just won't fit. And it just takes a little bit of seasoning to understand that you're not going to make it fit. If it doesn't fit, if it doesn't look exactly the same as the one you took off, then you need to give that one back and have somebody else look up the part number for you again. Anyways, 602-508-0960, if you have a car question or a car problem, you're welcome to give us a call, and we'll do the best we can with respect to who it is that that we can send you to or refer you to. The whole purpose of this is to empower you as the car owner to ask the right questions or to hold the shop's feet to the fire. The most important part of our industry is maintenance and keeping your car in good shape, but we can over-maintain it, and that benefits me as a shop owner. That doesn't benefit you. So if I can talk you into flushing your transmission fluid twice a year, that really benefits me, and it does absolutely nothing for you. Nothing. So all the winner of that particular conversation is me, because I get to do it twice. And there's no risk and reward. And that's what it's all about with car repairs, risk and reward. So if I can cock you into flushing your transmission, twice a year, then with newer fluid, there's a good chance the transmission is going to last slightly longer than it would otherwise had you not changed the fluid. So there is a benefit to doing it, but then there's what happens when I decide to try to talk you into doing it. Let's do it two times a year. And if we flush the transmission, and of course it's a $300 or $400 job, but if we flush the transmission twice a year, then there's a good chance it's never going to go bad. Well, that's just not true. That's just not true. There's too many pieces inside of a transmission that can fail that cause the whole transmission to turn into a just nothing, where you're on the side of the road and you have neutral and park, and that's all you have. You don't have drive or reverse. So those are the issues that you have. All righty, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. We're going to come back with another hour of fun, and during that period of time, we're going to be talking about car repair, and you can ask questions, and I'm really good with respect to answering or talking about a dispute between a husband and a wife. Now, I remember one time, one of the biggest disputes that we ever had on radio, and I've been doing radio in the Valley since 1988, was whether you should put your car in neutral at a traffic light or not. That just got legs of its own. That became a whole issue all of its own. And I'm surprised that it hasn't come up before. But the discussion was evenly distributed between those that knew and those that thought they knew. And everybody picked a side, but in reality, at the end of the day, putting your car into neutral at a traffic light, and then when the light turns green, putting it into drive and leave, there is no substantial benefit to doing that at all. Period. You're not going to save any money. You're not going to save any fuel economy. You're not going to save any wear and tear on the transmission. All you're going to do is wear out the transmission linkage a little sooner than you would otherwise have, because you're going to be moving it in and out of gear every time you come to a traffic light. So you're going to go from drive to neutral and wait till it turns green and then go back down to drive. Well, I suggest that that's a huge waste of time. I suggest that you just put your foot on the brake and wait till the light turns green and then hit the gas and go. But those are the kinds of issues that we've often had, is what's beneficial and who's it beneficial to. And that's the big deal. So the manual, your owner's manual in your car, is written for the car. You should follow that, and no one should supersede that. No one should talk you out of that. No one should tell you should change your ways. Well, you're in Arizona. I know, but see, the manual was written for Arizona people. There's no such thing as an Arizona owner's manual for a car or a truck or a motorhome or a boat or whatever. There's no such thing. The manual was written by the people that built the car. And they're saying, we think you should do the transmission services every 35,000 miles. Not every year, which is 12 to 15,000 miles, every 30,000, usually that's every 2 years for most people. So that's the hard part. The hard part is that who is benefiting if we speed up your maintenance program? Who benefits the most? And I can promise you the answer is not you. The only person that benefits by speeding up any kind of maintenance interval is the shop. It's not going to make your transmission last longer. No one knows when the light bulb's going to burn out in your transmission or in your air conditioning compressor or anything like that. Nobody knows when that light bulb burns out. The bottom line is it can be tomorrow, and nobody knows in advance that that's going to happen. So those are the kinds of issues that you have. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960, and you're welcome to join us any way you want. And it's every Saturday. We're here from 10 to 12 talking about cars. And Gil is the engineer. He's the one that answers the phone. And he says, hi, do you want to talk to Mark? And then you say yes. And then he takes your name. And then he whispers it into my ears. And then I put you on my piece of paper. And I call your name when it's your turn. Right now, we don't have anybody waiting. So the line is wide open. 602-508-0960. My name is Mark Salem. Gil is the engineer. He's the one that makes sure I hit all my marks. And we talk about his car and my car. But we also talk about our wives. But that's not going to be something we're going to do in public, because both of us know that that's just really a very bad idea. Well, welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock. We're going to be here for another hour talking about car repair problems, car repair dilemmas. What do you do about this? And should I do this? Should I do that? Whatever, whatever. And we can do that. We're going to do that real quick. But first, let me just tell you about Blackwell Automotive, 40th Street in Greenway. Tom's a good guy. He has a really nice shop. He's well-versed in the vintage car restoration kind of stuff, as well as anything passenger car, light truck, anything that you or your wife or your kids drive. He's well-versed in all of that. And he's got that whole northeast Scottsdale area covered, because I can't find anybody else to help him. There are lots of shops up there, but I'm looking for the guys that are really the very best guys that have a tremendous amount of experience, and they actually take good care of their customers, and Blackwell Automotive is just exactly that guy. At 40th Street and Greenway, Tom Blackwell at Blackwell Automotive. Let's go to the phones, and we're going to go to Jay. Jay, thank you for holding. How can I help you?
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I have a pesky leak. It's right after a new seal on a drive shaft. And in the past, I've had success using something called AT205. It's something that you add to the transmission fluid. It's no longer available, disappeared from the market. What are your thoughts on either finding it or a good substitute?
Well, we would oftentimes put brake fluid in power steering systems or transmission systems, and the brake fluid would cause the rubber seals to return some pliability and also cause them to swell a tad. And in the old days, we were pretty successful in putting a half a pint of DOT-3 brake fluid in a transmission or a power steering system and being able to slow down or sometimes eliminate leaks altogether. I'm not familiar with anything other than brake fluid, because brake fluid, that's what brake fluid does. It causes rubber to swell, and that's good when you're trying to fix a leak. I'm not familiar with anything that was in a can that would help that, because since the 60s, all the people I've hung around with and all the older gray-haired guys that I learned from, brake fluid was the magic lotion for that. So
What about the unintended? What about unintended consequences of
none?
We swelling don't. All the seals?
No. I mean, I'm suggesting that you might put 3 ounces or 4 ounces of brake fluid inside the transmission. That's all. I'm not talking about a half a gallon of brake fluid. But keep in mind, transmission fluid is a hydraulic fluid, and so is brake fluid. So it's not as if we're using engine oil. Because engine oil is not a hydraulic fluid. So as long as you're using the hydraulic oil, then you should be okay. But if I have seen guys go crazy, because if a half a bottle of DOT-3 brake fluid will do good, then 3 bottles will do better. But I've never seen anybody swell a seal to 3 or 4 times its normal size, and then that causes a completely new issue where we have to go through and just reseal the entire unit. So I haven't seen that, but I haven't seen anybody go crazy like that at all either. So that's how I would do it. I'd just use a DOT-3 brake fluid, and just figure out that I'm going to probably put is maybe 3 or 4 ounces in and see what happens. That's what I'd do. Okay?
Fantastic. Thanks, Mark.
Okay, you bet. Jim, you're up next. How can I help you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, the vehicle has a keyed mark in the side left front panel, and then and about 18 inches into the door panel. And I'm just wondering what a fix might look like as far as material involved.
Well, it's kind of hard because I mean, it's difficult to describe it, but you've got a scratch or a key mark on the exterior portion of your car on one of the doors?
On the left front panel, and then about 18 inches into the door panel.
Okay, so...
And at some point, it does go pretty deep.
Okay. Well, that's not anything that's you should be losing sleep over.
Well, it's... What it amounts to is I'm paying out of the pocket for this, so I'm wondering what I can expect as far as do they have to do the whole left front panel and the door?
You can't paint half the fender and think it's going to look good in 6 months. So the answer is if you've got body damage to two panels that adjoin one another, like a fender and a door, then you're going to end up painting both of them. And the proper procedure is to go in there and grind all the paint off of the damaged area and put body putty in there and use your skills to bring the metal back to as close as perfect as you can. And then you're gonna sand it, and then you're gonna prime it, then you're gonna paint it, then you're gonna clear coat it. So I want to tell you that there's lots of these young men and there's a lot of people out there that drive around and leave business cards on people's, and they say, well, I can fix it. I'm a former body guy. That never works. That never works. So what they do is they go in and they just scrape off all the paint. They put a bunch of body filler in there that could be a quarter of an inch to a half an inch deep. Then they sand it off, and then they spray some black paint on it. And they go, there you go. And you go, wait a minute, you're not done. I was just going to do the body work. So what happens now? Well, you just take it somebody and have them paint it. So you take it to a place and you say, paint it. And he goes, I'm not going to paint that. He's got, you know, half an inch of Bondo on top of that. He didn't do any metal restoration. He just filled the big crease with Bondo. And so I'm not going to hang my hat on that. I'm not going to, and 6 months from now, you're going to come back in here and go, hey, look, after you painted it, this whole landslide of Bondo just fell off and it exposed this big, huge dent that was there at the very beginning. So I think it's a bad idea to do that. I see that all the time in my world. And, it's just not a pretty sight. My neighbor did that not too long ago. And, what was funny is I was teasing him by saying to him, you have way too much Bondo. That fender weighs about 40 more pounds more than the other fender on the other side of the car, and we were laughing about that. So then fast forward about four months later, he calls me and he goes, did you knock that piece of Bondo off my car? And I go, come on. Of course I didn't. What happened? And he goes, well, he says, it fell off. And so I said, send me a picture. He sends me a picture, and sure enough, just the whole piece of Bondo came off. So he never even applied the Bondo to the repaired area properly. So you could do whatever you want, but there's really no shortcuts. If you're never going to win, if you're going to hire somebody off the street you've never met before to do the work in your garage, it just won't work, and you'll be sorry. But then you're free to do whatever you want to do. Did that cover it?
Okay, I'm 83rd and Indian School area. Can you recommend someone?
83rd and Indian School. I think what I would do is I would call Harker's Automotive, and I would say to them, what paint and body shop do you guys use? I think that the guys who know the good body shops in a geographical area are the mechanical guys, because we want those guys to fix a mess that we made. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so call one or two of the mechanical shops in the area, the geographical area, and ask them, who would you hire to fix damage that you did to a customer's car? and they'll be able to help you with that. There was a guy down in Tempe that we used on a regular basis because we just had. I mean, sometimes we damaged our own cars, sometimes we damaged coaster cars, whatever. It just took. But he just recently closed his shop up, and so my shop is now without someone to refer to because he just aged out. He was an older gentleman, and he just decided that he had had enough of the Bondo dust in his lungs and closed his doors. Somebody opened up his shop, but it's not anybody that we have a history with, so we're a little leery about doing that. But another thing you can do, too, is call an automotive paint distributor and ask them, who does really good work and doesn't blame you because they didn't mix the color right? Who's the shop that's been around a really long time and that never complains and pays their bills on time? Who's that shop? And that would help you as well. Okay?
I appreciate your time.
Okay. Good luck, Jim. Thank you very much. Matt, you're up next. How can I help you?
Hey, Mark. My question's about avoiding as much maintenance as possible on a brand new car right out of the factory. I've heard that you want to keep it below like 50 miles an hour for the first 500 miles. How accurate is that? And what am I looking for? What would happen if I took it over 50?
Oh, I'm going to just blow your whole bubble right up. I want you to drive it like you stole it.
Really?
And that's the way I do it. Now, here, let me explain. If you took a brand new horse out of the barn and you walked him a mile to the mailbox and then you walked him back and you did that every day for a year, that horse would never be worth a damn. But if you walked him and then you kind of trotted him and then you kind of ran him and then you, at the last maybe 30, 40 yards, you kind of run him hard, that horse is going to be a whole lot better off. So the answer is the car's not going to let you abuse the motor. I promise you that. But when you accelerate really hard, you're by yourself, you're out in the middle of nowhere, and you're going to accelerate and the speed limit's 65 and you're going to go up to 75 and then back off the throttle. That's the key, that sentence right there that I just glossed over. You throttle up hard, but then you back off, and that oils everything up. So you're polishing the internal components of the engine, and it's not a good idea to just shove it to the floor and let it go until it gets 100. That's a bad idea. But you're on the throttle, and you're off the throttle. So when you're on, you're polishing, and you're oiling, and then when you're off, you're cooling down. So there's nothing that you're going to be able to do other than hurt it if you treat it too nicely. I don't want you to think that I'm going to say go out and abuse it. I'm going to say just drive it normally. Just drive it normally. Forget about that it's got a brand new motor in it. Just drive it normally. However you normally drive, then drive it that way. And if every once in a while you decide that you're going to shove the throttle to the floor, hit passing gear and pass somebody, go ahead, do it. It's okay. Today we don't have the problems that we had with breaking in motors that we had in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Motors are really, really durable, really, really good, and we have oil that we had never had before. So that's why you can go 15,000 miles on an oil change and you don't have to worry about it. So don't baby it. Just I want you to, how do I put this? Take a hot cup of coffee and put it between your legs and try not to spill it. But take it to the edge of almost spilling it, okay? So you're going to hot rod it every once in a while. You're going to look around at Sunday morning. You're on your way to the golf to go play golf, and there's nobody around. And as you get onto the freeway, you just stuff it to the floor, and you bring it on up to 70 miles an hour real quick, and then you back off of it, and you take the next exit. That's okay. That's okay. That none of that's going to hurt anything at all. Does that make sense?
Good enough for me. Yes, thank you so much.
All righty. Good luck. Thank you very much. All righty. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. And we've got Dave. Dave, stay right there, and I'll be back with you in just a minute.
21 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. Every Saturday we're here from 10 to 12 talking about car-related issues, car problems, car maintenance, what kind of oil, what should I do this, should I do that. This shop says I need to do that, the other shop says he's crazy, and blah, blah, blah. Those are the things we can help you with. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. Strictly Diesel Service and Repair is a shop that I really respect, and I respect Nate, the owner. He's up at I-17 and Pinnacle Peak Road. He knows Chevys, Dodges, and Fords as well as anybody that I've ever met before. He's honest as the day is long. He's not a braggart. He just listens. He's a really good listener, but he's a really good fixer. And he'll always make sure that you understand completely what's going to happen now, tomorrow, the next day, and tomorrow after that. He's just really good about what he does. Plus, he also has a website that's really kind of cool because you can go there and look at a lot of different options, aftermarket options, and parts available that you can put on your Chevy, your Ford, or your Dodge diesel. So Strictly Diesel Service and Repair is a go-to business as far as I'm concerned, and they sell parts 24 hours a day on their website, Strictly Diesel Service and Repair. Let's go to the phones, and let's go to Dave. Dave, thank you for holding. How can I help you?
Dave, Mark, long-time listener, good show. I love it. I got two questions regarding diesel vehicles,
okay.
Newer diesel motors. And I don't throw out any names. I did call one of your shops off your list and another shop. Both are well known in the valley regarding lubricity for diesel fuels. The newer diesels, I say, is 2019 and forward. A lot of them has switched to CP4 pumps. Lucky for me, first time owner of a new diesel, I purchased a 2021 Ram Cummins, the high output. They did switch back to the CP3 because they were seeing early failure rates on their 19s and 20s. The fuel additives for lubricity is the reason I called those shops. Your shop on one of your lists, won't say no names, did say, yeah, they do run it. They call another one that's not on your list. They say, I would revert to the owner's manual by default and see what they recommend. The Mopar manual doesn't state about running any additives other than for low temps for gelling of diesel fuel regarding lubricity. My second question is regarding oil for the same said diesels. Their interval's 15,000 miles. I'm currently just in about 1,500 miles on break-in. I'll probably change it before that 15K. But if I don't reach that every year, should I default and change it every year or not regarding the oil, or wait till I hit, if it takes maybe 2.5 to 3 years to hit that 15K mark?
Okay.
The only two questions I had.
Okay, well, just change the question around. Mark, what do you do about the lubricity and the pump lube and all that kind of stuff? And the answer is nothing. Okay? Nothing. Nothing.
Okay.
And I'm not interested in all the different ideas about lubricity and wearing out the pump and stuff like that. I got 130,000 miles on my one-ton Dodge truck. It's a 12. I got a 12, so I didn't have to deal with all the emissions requirements that came in the 13. So I'm real happy. I run an oil analysis every once in a while. I know what I'm looking at. I'm looking for growth of metal. Abnormal growth of metal. So if the number is 5 every time I change the oil and I do an oil analysis and the metal content is 5, I'm happy with that. But if I go from 5 to 35, then something's wrong. As far as the what was the second part of that? The lubricity was the first one, and the second one was
oil interchange intervals. Okay. They're saying 15K in the owner's manual. I may not get that every year. I'm retired. I do pull a trailer. I'm going to do some traveling my trailer, but I probably won't hit that 15K mark every year. It may take a year and a half, almost two.
Okay. Well, here's the answer to your question. We need to get the engine temperature up over 220 in order to boil the water out of the oil. So if you're hauling the trailer, more than likely you're getting the engine temperature up over 220. Your turbo's running probably somewhere between 800 and maybe 11, 12, 13, 1400 degrees. So we are exercising it. On mine, I use a 20 weight, a diesel 20, and I change it every 15,000 miles, and I run my trucks really hard, and I'm pulling tractors and excavators and horses, and I'm hauling a big piece of steel up to Payson here in the near future. So I don't
I don't think I'd worry about the 15,000 mile. If you wanted to do it once a year, then I would probably do it. I would probably change the oil and go through the summertime with fresh oil. So if you wanted to just do it once a year, it's okay. You can or can't. There's no rules or anything like that. But in your particular case, I'd probably just start at the beginning of the summer. And as long as you get through the summer, then you can go the full year and then change it again. So we're not doing additives in the fuel tanks. We feel pretty confident that the additives that they're out there are really make a good amount of money for the people that are selling them, and really they don't have a positive benefit to the overall life. Plus, if you don't abuse your Dodge, and if I don't abuse mine, that motor's probably going to be running sweet as punch 300,000 and 400,000 miles from now. And I already have, like I say, 130, 140 already on my 12. So now I'm going to defer too that there's going to be other diesel guys in town that I really do respect and that we're good friends. We're going to have a difference in that kind of discussion. There's going to be guys out there that want to use this kind of oil. Salem pours Chevron, but I'm going to pour Valvoline, or I'm going to pour Motorcraft, or I'm going to pour this, or I'm going to pour that. We all have those idiosyncrasies with respect to our own personal stuff, but it's what I do with mine and what Alan does with his trucks, his diesels, and all of the, we have a tremendous amount of construction companies that we work for. And one of the big concrete companies has a bunch of diesels that we service that we're responsible for. And so we're going to use pretty much the parameters available to us at the owner's manual. And then we'll change and adapt if we need to. Here's a good example of it. We've got one guy who just won't stop idling his diesel. He won't shut it off. So we're bringing him in for earlier oil changes than all the rest of the trucks because he's sitting there idling forever and listening to the radio or doing whatever he's not supposed to be doing. So when we look at his time, and he'll admit, I never shut my thing off. Okay, well then we're going to have to change the way we do your oil changes to compensate for the fact that you don't know how to shut the truck off and walk away from it. So those are the kinds of issues that you have, but those are few and far between.
I thank you. I value your opinion. You did clear up the air. I just wanted to get a general feeling of two shops, one on the list, one not, and then your opinion.
Yeah.
Being first-time diesel owner. I thank you. You cleared up the air.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Thank you. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Ellen, I'm going to talk to you, but I'm going to have to cut it short, and then we're going to do a break, and then I'm going to answer your question. So just tell me what you got on your mind.
I happen to have a 2016 Hyundai Elantra, and I've recently moved here from Colorado. I'm trying to find a shop that would be able to, something that's place that's honest, that would give me where I could service my car.
Okay. Okay. I can help you with that. What part of town are you going to end up?
I'm in North Scottsdale.
Okay. Okay. Blackwell Automotive is at 40th and Greenway. And I've
Blackwell
known Tom.
Automotive.
Yep, and I've known Tom for probably better than 20 years. And we're two peas of the pod. We're both kind of ornery, and we're both pretty well educated. But if you were, I would send. I'm really comfortable in knowing that I'm sending you to Blackwell because he's not going to take advantage of you. He's not going to lie. He's not going to sell you a whole bunch of stuff you don't need. I got to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Thank you, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem, and I just wanted to touch base real quick with Ellen. One real quick time. Ellen, Tom and I have been friends for a very long time. He's not going to sell you anything you don't need. He's not going to sell you all kinds of magic potions and lotions, and then he's going to leave you with the idea that if you spend $300, your car's going to love you and never break down. None of that will happen. All you need to do, Ellen, is develop a relationship, go in for your oil changes at their correct mileage amount, and then they'll look your car over like the rest of us do as well. Is Ellen going to be able to go another 8,000 miles without anything or not? So it's a matter of just looking at the owner's manual and knowing exactly what needs to be done, and that's it. obviously you, if you have an idiosyncrasy or you've got a problem with the car where in the morning when you start it up, it puffs a small amount of black smoke and it doesn't only does it in the morning. Those are things that you can bring to their attention. But most of the time, that example I gave you is nothing to be concerned about. I just used that as an example. So, Ellen, good luck to you. Aaron, you're up next. How can I help you?
Oh, yes, I just had a quick question. I bought a used car. It's a 2005 Chevy Suburban, a 1500 two-wheel drive. And it's got a real, like, smell coming out of the exhaust. And whenever I hit the gas, there's black smoke that comes out.
Okay. The smell,
yes,
is it?
I can correct myself.
Okay. Is it? Is the smell kind of a rotten egg smell?
No, it's more like a chemical smell, I want to say.
Okay. Well, it shouldn't. It shouldn't be puffing black smoke out the tailpipe. And and more than likely, it's going to be running rich in that particular RPM and load range. And the question is why?
Okay.
So is something wrong with the fuel pressure regulator where the fuel pressure regulator, it's a rubber diaphragm and it's leaking fuel? So that really isn't that big of a deal. If it idles smoothly, okay, and if when you pull up to a traffic light and the light's red and you put your foot on the brake and you can hardly tell the motor's running and it's nice and smooth, that's good news. Because if you had a valve that was dancing around or if it had a broken valve spring, you'd have a backfire and you haven't said anything about all that. So as far as the black smoke is...
I'm sorry. It runs a little hard. It idles hard, but I'm not getting any planking or anything like that.
Okay.
Or any misfires.
Yeah. If you want to chase anything, chase the black smoke because it should blow a little black smoke on wide open throttle, hard acceleration. That's normal. But any other time, it's not normal. So if the light turns green, you're all by yourself, and you just decide to dust the motor out just a little bit, all the way to the floor, if you see black smoke, that's kind of normal. But if you're sitting there to a traffic light, and the light turns green, and you just, you know, drive across the intersection normal, and you look in your rearview mirror, and you're laying down black smoke, that's not normal. So you'll have to have that addressed somehow. But the good news is most of the time it's something to do with the fuel system and it's got some kind of a diaphragm or some kind of a fuel leak that's causing it to run richer than it should. And once you fix that problem, you're home free. Is that okay?
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Aaron. Carlos, you're up next. How can I help you?
I've got an 02 Chevy short bed with a 5.3 and I probably have 170,000 miles on it. The only problem I've ever had with it is towing a boat up out of Bartlett, coming up the hill. It got warm on me. As soon as I crested the hill, and you're probably familiar with it, the truck cooled off, and no, I've never had a problem with it. Other than the other day, I had the truck just using it to move stuff around here in the yard, and... So I never got it out on the road. I was just kind of idling around, and it warmed up.
Okay, now what? Describe warmed up, though. Give me the what is that? What does that mean?
Up to where you'd start to concern, where the gauge gets up into the red.
Okay, so it's past the three-quarter mark.
160 plus. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And when I was doing the work here in the yard, I just drove out the driveway and went down the road. It cooled off. I came back in, but I don't understand, you know, what I'm worried about is if I give my wife the truck and she's headed up north and I-17 stops and she has to sit there with the AC running.
Okay.
I don't want the truck to overheat and leave her overheated as well. So,
okay.
If you're just driving normal, it never gets hot.
Okay, but stop. We need to talk about specifics, okay?
Okay.
So, I want the truck to run between half and three-quarter on the gauge. That's okay.
Yep.
Okay, that's where I want it. And if you're sitting around and you're loading stuff from your house and the car's running and stuff like that, and then you get in and you say, okay, well, it's past the three-quarters mark and it's flirting with the red zone, but as soon as I got in it and as soon as I drove away, it came down immediately, that's normal.
Yes.
So
okay.
Now the fan clutch... would be a situation where we're sitting and it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter, and as soon as we start moving, the temperature of the coolant comes down dramatically. That's the classic example of a bad fan clutch.
Okay.
So
that must be the problem.
And I think you and I have guessed right. I think the problem that you've got, because you said you were working in your yard, you had it running, and it was hot, and then when you got in and you drove it away, it cooled down right off the bat. Those are pretty classic fan clutch. Don't buy the cheapest fan clutch. Buy a name brand fan clutch, because there's lots of cheap ones out there that are just big pieces of dog poo poo. So and it's not a bad idea to get on the internet and go to some of the auto parts stores and just look at a fan clutch for your old Chevy 5.3, and then you can decide based on price. You're not you don't want the most expensive one, but you don't want the cheapest one.
Okay. And would that scenario, is it possible the same scenario pulling the boat up out of the lake, or is that a different, does that lead you to something different?
Well, if you're pulling it up out of the lake and you don't get past the three-quarter mark, I'm not real concerned about that. Because, like I said, you're supposed to run between half and three-quarters on your gauge. You're still three needle widths away from red zone when you're at the three-quarter mark. So you still got a lot of buffer room there. But I understand here's the answer to your question. If you see it get hot and you see it cool down, that's what it's supposed to do. If you know, I'm pulling out of Bartlett, I'm coming up with some hills, I'm pulling the boat, yes, I see it's getting warm on me, yes, I see it gets to three-quarter, yes, I see it gets past the three-quarter, and I get to the top and I'm starting down, boom, it cools down real good, that's normal. That's just normal.
Okay. I guess the only thing I have, I have two trucks, and the other one has the same motor. It's an extended cab long bed that I use for work every day. And I think I could start that thing on the hottest day of summer and leave it sit idle. Of course, it's got electric fans. The O2 doesn't. But the O8 never gets hot. I mean, you could sit there and parked on the I-17 with the AC running, and it never goes above 210.
Okay, now has the O8 got the electric fans or the clutch fan?
It has the electric.
Okay. Well, I want to tell you something. I hate electric fans. I just hate them. I just hate them because they're just problematic, and they do work when they work well. The problem is oftentimes you say to your customers, well, you have one bad fan, and then you end up putting both of them in there, and the bill's $500-$600.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not I like the clutch fan because I like to hear the fan clutch lock. I like to hear it moving air. I like to hear it disengage when I get up about 45 miles an hour. So I like the idea of the fan clutch. I'm not a real big fan of electric cooling fans. Now, I'm going to move that, if you have electric cooling fans, I'm going to move that area up even higher, because remember I told you like half to three quarters is okay. Well, we're going to move that even up further if you're going to be running electric cooling fans, because the fans are going to take, there's a delayed reaction. The fan will come on, but it's going to take a little longer than normal to get you back down. So as long as you're okay with that, then you're okay. As long as you can stay out of the red and you know that you know why you're hot and you know how to get it to cool off, you're okay. You're okay.
All right. Appreciate your help.
All right.
Thank you.
You betcha. We'll be back. Wait a minute. I think I need to take a break, right?
Yes, you do.
Oh, gosh almighty. I'm sorry, Gil. Anyway, we'll be right back after this. Well, welcome back, everybody. 45 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. We're going to go and we're going to pick up Nicholas because he's been waiting. And then we also have Wayne. So, Wayne, you stay there. But, Nicholas, you're first. How can I help you?
Hi there. I'm changing the water pump on my car. It came with a metal gasket. The instructions say to use silicon grease on it, which is, I've never heard of that. It's a metal gasket, and it's got like a little tiny strip of rubber around each opening that's almost so small you can't see it. And that side goes towards the pump. Now, what's the silicon grease about, and do I put anything else on the other side?
I mean, it doesn't really make any difference on which side you put the grease. You can put it on one or both. It makes no difference. The whole idea behind the silicone grease is that we want to be able to, when we put the water pump over the timing cover orifice, wherever you're pulling it from, we want to be able to, that gasket's got to be able to slide a little left or slide a little right as we tighten it up. So that's the reason why we're calling it grease, is because we don't want the gasket to just be pounded into one place and never move. We want to, you torque it, the water pump housing, you're going to be moving that gasket just a little bit, and that's what we want to happen.
I see. So it has nothing to do with feeling it, I guess. So that's fine.
No.
So the other part is just solid metal with no rubber. That's the part that goes up against the block. So I put any kind of a gasket maker, silicone or anything on that?
Yeah, I would use a very thin film of silicone on one side. I don't want the gasket slipping on both sides. I want it only on one side.
Right. Okay, I have this DAP gasket maker 100% RTV silicone.
That's good.
So I guess I could use that on the metal side. On the metal side, and put the grease on the other on the side that goes towards the pump itself.
You can do it. You can do it any way you want. All we want is we want to make sure that the gasket can move and fit as we start to tighten up the water pump over its mounting brackets and stuff. And then we're going to, after we tighten it up good, we also know that the silicone, the RTV that you're going to end up with using is going to fill up any small imperfections. So
I can use that instead of the silicone grease as long as I do it when it's wet?
Yeah, yeah, just a thin film.
I didn't know what
you... I don't want you...
I got it, so...
I don't want you, when you're tightening it down, to be goobering all kinds of RTV out of the connection.
Right.
Just a thin film on both sides as if you're just, wiping it with your finger, okay?
Yeah, I can do that. So okay. What is a silicone grease anyway? I've got all kinds of stuff here, but no silicone grease. Does it come in like a tube or?
Yeah, you could.
What is it used for besides this?
There's just a lot of, it doesn't make any difference. Some guys want gasket sealers that's going to allow the gasket to move and slide and slip, and I agree with that. But other guys are not going to want that. So everybody has their own name for different stuff, and I want to tell you, I don't know that you should get caught up in the silicone grease or the grease or this or that. Just use a nice good RTV. Don't use too much of it.
Okay.
Make sure that you've got it on both sides of the gasket, and you're home free.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just worried about putting it together and having it leaking.
No,
thanks a lot.
Okay, you betcha.
All right.
Wayne, you're up next. How can I help you?
I have a 2016 Dodge Grand Caravan, 115,000 miles, and it is new to me. There is a slight shimmy in the steering wheel at highway speed, 70, 75 miles an hour, and it's... If you look at the seam on the leather-wrapped steering wheel and you let go of the wheel for, a second or two, it vibrates back and forth maybe a 16th of an inch. My wife doesn't even notice it, but I do. And so I'm wondering what normally causes shimmies. A little history on the vehicle. I know it was a salvage vehicle from hitting a deer when it was 1 year old. And I'm not sure the mileage at that point, but there's a history. And I was wondering, is it, potentially a bent wheel? What are the things that cause a shimmy like that?
Well,
very slight, but there.
It can be a lot of things, but you've hit on many of them. The diagnostic portion is the most important, and that's just laying down underneath the front of it. And most of us, we have hoists that we put it up on the rack, or we put it on an alignment rack and lift it up. Somebody's inside, the engine's running, the car's in park, and he just takes his hand and puts it at 12 o'clock, and then he just a little bit to the left, and a little bit back to center, and then a little bit to the right, and a little bit back to center. And somebody underneath is just looking at all the rubber components and all the tie rod ends and all that kind of stuff. So all we're looking for is play. We want to stand outside the car, and we want to see him turn the steering wheel left and right, and then we want to look quickly left and see that the tire, the steering wheel, and the front tires are working in complete conjunction with one another. We don't want any play or delay between moving the steering wheel and seeing movement from the driver's or the driver's front tire or the passenger front tire. So this really isn't that big of a deal. The shimmy is going to be caused by play, and it's easy to find it if you just get down. But you also have to make sure that if your wife's going to be in the car, turn the steering wheel left and right, that she still loves you, because it'll be easier for her to put it in drive and drive over your head. So you just have to
use... I don't love my wife, but she's not mechanically inclined at all.
Well, I know, but you can teach her how to put her hand on the steering wheel at 12 o'clock with the engine running, the car's in park, the parking brake is on, and you're going to teach her how to put her hand on the 12 o'clock position, and you're just going to tell her to move one finger to the left and then back to center, and then move one finger to the right and then back to center, and you're going to look underneath the car and watch the front end and see if from the steering wheel all the way down to the tie rod ends, and that includes the rack and pinion, that includes the mountings for the rack and pinion, that includes all the rubber mounts, all of that has to be looked at. So it is something that we do work on a lot. It's not that big of a deal. It really is pretty easy to identify and know what's causing the shimmy. But it could be a tire, and if that's the case, then you drive the car, she drives the car, you on Sunday morning, you drive next to her, and you look at the tire, and you can see if the tire's wobbling itself. It could be a wheel bearing that's causing this as well, and you'll see that. What we do is we just put it up in the air and then put a dial indicator on both the front wheels and see if we've got a wheel bearing problem. That's how we do it.
Okay. What would be the cost of diagnostic? Obviously, it depends upon parts and what have you for repair, but what would be diagnostic costs for that to bring it to your shop?
Well,
I live in Chandler.
Why don't you just do it with an oil change, and more than likely nobody's going to charge you for it.
Okay.
Realistically, I'll write a work order, because you want me to check to see if there's any play in the steering wheel. So I'm going to write a work order, and I'm going to dispatch it. Then it's going to go from the dispatcher to the technician. The technician is going to get it from the service rider. The service rider is going to get it, car pulled up front, put it on the rack, and we're going to put it on, blah, 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 blah. All this crap for nothing. Just let us do your next oil change and bring it when you bring it in and say, listen, there's a little bit of play on the front steering. Would you take a look at that?
Thank you.
The answer to the question is, under those circumstances with an oil change, the diagnostic is probably going to be less than $25, even if they charge you. That's it.
Sure.
All righty.
Thank you.
All right. Good luck to you. The diagnostic question is always really difficult, because everybody has a different expectation. And the diagnostic is, we're supposed to figure out what the symptoms are and then what the possibilities are. And then we're supposed to check all the possibilities and then determine what's causing the problem. Is it a wheel bearing? Is it a tie rod end? Is it a wheel that's not torqued properly? On and on and on and on. That's the problem. But if you can couple those with something that you're going to have done anyway, can you take a look at this and let me know what you think it costs, or what if, I mean, I'm going to bring my car in for an oil change, and I've got this little bit of a shimmy, a left and right shake of the steering wheel when we drive down the road sometimes, just a little bit of a left and right shake. Can you look at that while you're doing the oil changes and see if you can see any play or what's causing that? What do I need to deal with, or give me an estimate on the repair? That's kind of the easy way through that point. Anyway, 602, nope, we're not going to do that. What I am going to tell you about is two other shops in town that I'm really proud to be a part of a group of shops that are really, really good and have been around a long time. I've known Tom, who owns Action Auto Repair at I-17 in Deer Valley, since 1983. I've known him since 1983. We have been very good friends since 1983. And I have no problems with sending people up to Action Auto Repair, I-17 in Deer Valley, because he's going to figure out what the problem is. He's really good at what he does. He has great staff. And that's really the mark of really the best shops in town, is they have good staff. Long-time guys. Tom's got guys there that probably have been with him for 10 and 15 years. That's a relationship that you should value as a customer, because one guy knows what the other guy's thinking, and that's what it's all about in car repair. So Action Auto Repair, I-17 in Deer Valley, and he is really good at getting you to be a part of the decision-making process about what your car needs and why, so that you can make informed decisions. There's no high pressure over at Action Auto Repair. When it comes to car maintenance, your car's not going to love you any more
if you change your oil twice as often as you normally should. Because your car doesn't have a brain. It does have a brain, and it'll have four or five different brains. It'll have a computer that runs the air conditioning, the ABS. It'll have a computer that runs fuel controls. It has computers that run the lighting. It has all that. The problem is it just doesn't care. So the idea is that if you decide to over-maintain your car, there's really no benefit to that. All you're going to do is spend a whole lot of money for a false sense of security. That's what it really boils down to. So just do what you're supposed to do on your oil changes and let the chips fall where they may. All of us in the industry, most of us in the industry, understand our responsibility is to do this. You bring your car in for an oil change and you're on an 8,000-mile interval. My job is to look your car over to make sure, do my best to make sure that your car's going to make it the next 8,000 miles. I'm just trying to look in advance. I'm like looking in the future. Is there anything that's going to cause a problem between now and the next oil change? That's really the best you can ask for your shop to do. Most of us don't have crystal balls where we can look and see what's going to happen with your car, but we are experienced enough to be able to look at tire wear and oil leaks and performance of the cooling system and the air conditioning system and be able to come to some kind of conclusion. So those are the easy parts when it gets down to
it. 1 minute.
And guilt. Did you say something?
Yeah, one minute.
Oh, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. That's right. Auto Dynamics is another place. He's in Sun City. I've known Chuck since the 70s. And Chuck is a good guy. He's been around a long time. He's worked for a variety of different gasoline companies. But today, Auto Dynamics is Sun City's largest and most trusted source for complete automotive services. And they've been around in that vicinity since 1982. So they're not going to sell you unnecessary parts or repairs. So if you're looking for the shop that I recommend for that area, for the Sun City area, then Auto Dynamics, north side of Grand, just west of 99th Avenue. My email address is Mark, with a K, at MarkSalem.com. Mark at MarkSalem.com. You're always welcome to send me an email. We'll have a nice conversation. If you'll give me your phone number, I like to call you back because I'm going to have some questions that you didn't answer. And I'm going to call back from a blocked line for obvious reasons. We'll see you next week.